Shalom Aleichem, Avoy Sai. We are in Chovis Halvavis, Shah Avoida Serlekim, Perek Tess.
It's the bottom of page 332 in the English edition.
Ah, okay, Ashukayach. Perek Tess, it's toward the end, paragraph that begins, if you don't have that edition, it's paragraph that begins. I'm not sure exactly how the paragraphs break down. If you want to give, if you have a Hebrew one, you can ask me, I'll find the place. Yeah. Resh Pei Tes in the Resh edition. But if you're without a sefer, you should be fine. Okay. So we'll stop the Heichin Lach, even though I want to skip a bit further. The Chavis HaLevis has now been elaborating on how Hashem set us up in this world. And what we saw last week is that He compared it to a kind of like the way we put it. He said a heichal. Your body is a heichal. It's an office that you are given to operate in. Again, we're working the whole time with this premise that when you look in the mirror, what you see there is not you. It is, well, the way he's putting it now is the office that you operate in. You are your neshama. We keep repeating that. You are your neshama. You have a job to do in this world. And the body is the office, perfectly equipped to do the job. So now he's been describing, last week we spoke about the various things that he gave you to equip you for that job. He spoke about the senses. And now he's going to get to a little bit of a more fundamental place. Begin the chapter that begins Veheichin Loch, if you move a little bit further, Veheichin Loch Litzokech Shnei Yoyatzim. Is that how that paragraph begins? So that paragraph, yeah. Veheichin Loch Litzokech Shnei Yoyatzim. He provided you with two advisors. Vehivgid Aleim Shnei Seifrim. Now, each of those advisors comes with a scribe that records things. And he provided you with many servants, many assistants to do your job. Last week, just in order to illustrate this briefly, we spoke about he views all the different organs and functions and faculties of the body as servants that are put at your disposal, right? The example that we gave of that, if we really want to bring it home, is, for example, you actually have armies working for you. We talked about the white blood cells, thousands and thousands of soldiers who are busy patrolling your body to protect it, and they're willing to go to war and be moisa nefesh in order to protect you. That's just one example. But now let's move on. Bashnei Yoyatzim, who are these two advisors that he gives you? Ha'echon mehem hu ha-seichel. One of them is the seichel. The intellect, Hamoire Oischa Mashiesh Birtsoinokel, who instructs you as to what Hashem wants of you. Vayeitz Hasheni, who's the other advisor? Ta'avasech, your natural urges. That's how I'm going to translate Taiva now. Taiva, you know, means desire, lust. Right now, I'm going to just call it your natural urges in a more encompassing way. Which is why it's like Taiva as us wouldn't necessarily include laziness. Definition. So we're going to call it your natural urges. Okay? Asher tashiech v'tasitech v'ma shetaktif Hashem aleikim bar eich bar. Just follow that advisor, it will get you into trouble. It will get you to do all kinds of things that will anger Hashem. Follow your natural urges, not guided by the seichel, it's going to get you into trouble, inevitably. there's something that hasn't really brought into the picture here, and we'll have to talk about that. Where do the emotions come into play? It's kind of like we said, there's the seicha, and there are your titans, your natural urges. What about emotions? So we'll have to see that the emotions are actually a certain, we'll call it a certain connector between the two. We'll see, we'll see. Now, we're going to elaborate on all this. Vashnei Seifrim, as far as the two scribes, Echad Meim Koisev Ma'asai Chatoivim, Meseisu Begalu Ibn Matzmu. One of them is busy inscribing all the good things you did. Meseisu Begalu, the concealed things and the visible things, B'matzpun U'Benireh, what you did just in your heart, in your innermost thoughts, and what you did with your body in an obvious way. What you did with your body through the medium of the various servants that Hashem gave you, including your senses, your limbs. Okay. Skipping a little bit. The other scribe, is the one who keeps track of the wrong things you did. Along the lines of what we described when it comes to the good deeds, meaning everything is being kept track of. Any good thing that you did is being recorded. Not just any good thing that you did, but anything that's going on inside of you is also being recorded. That's why Hashem ultimately is really... Want to ask something?
Yeah, I wanted to ask you because these scribes are attached to the two things you just discussed, intellect and your inclination. So the way it implies is that things you do with your intellect are good and things you do based on your impulses are bad. I don't think that's necessarily true all the time.
Okay, good. Okay, good. So let's note the way he put it. The truth is here, you're really getting to what I want to talk about as we really develop the subject. What he's saying is, if we're talking in a broad way, if you'll be guided by your intellect all throughout life, you'll be on a good track. If you will always be guided by your inclinations, by your natural impulses, you will definitely be in a bad place. That's clear. Now, we're going to have to get to how to bring the two together. So we'll discuss this. This is really what we'll primarily be discussing today in the Tisha. Okay. So you know what? Let's get to the subject. We'll first go a little bit further, and then we'll elaborate. So we saw you have the one inscribing all of your good things, all your good deeds, and the ones just inscribing all of your bad deeds. And then he says, who are the ones who are actually helping implement those deeds in either direction? So v'amishosim v'ashamashim, those servants are himamidus hanafshis, are your various inclinations, your various character traits. Like what? Here he gives a long list. Ka'asimcha v'hada'aga. I think that in this context, I would translate simcha as, you see why, so optimism versus worry. Happiness, excitement versus sadness. Hazikaren v'ashikcha, memory versus forgetfulness. Interesting. I'll note this. We're going to be elaborating on all this at length. But I'll just note that he calls memory and forgetfulness midas, rather than just things that happen by themselves, meaning we wouldn't necessarily list memory and forgetting as midas. We might think that, you know, something happened, you remember it. It's not something not something I have an active role in or forgetting. But the truth is, as we'll see, it's not necessarily true. We want to be in a place where we remember things that are more important to us, we forget things that are less important to us. And I'll just give one example. Well, again, all these things we're going to be talking about more at length. I'll just give one example about memory. So certainly, you read a book and then you remember it a year later. That's not necessarily what we're discussing here. But what we are discussing, for example, is sometimes we actively hold on to memories. And sometimes it's wrong to do. Sometimes that's wrong to do. Like a classic example will be grudges. Sometimes a grudge can be felt just as acutely a few years down the line. Why? Because I don't want to let go of it. I don't want to let go of it, I'm holding on to it. This is from the finer areas of me, this that are harder to work on than others. But I do want to note that, yeah, sometimes a person can make a decision that, you know what, I don't want to continue to be focused on this. I'm going to forget about it. We'll see. Hachochma v'hasichus. Wisdom versus stupidity. Now this also, you might say, 1 minute, it's a question of a person's IQ. These are natural things. No, not necessarily. To a certain extent, that's true. But what I might say is, putting thought into things versus snot, that's also a meaning. That's also a meaning. Sometimes a person might accuse, let's say, someone close to you, a family member, a spouse, a child, a parent, might be quick to express some kind of grievance. And then all of a sudden the person says, 1 minute, do you remember that on that day I was busy taking care of something else for you at the same time? Oh yeah, right, I forgot. And it's quite possible that had you put a moment of thought in before just going ahead and expressing it, you might not have said what you said. So right now, when I'm talking about chokhmah versus sichlus, I'm not talking about the natural faculties. That is not a midah that a person has. But we're talking about where you decide to employ thought and where you decide not to employ thought. We should put thought into the things that we say. Yesterday in the drasha on Shabbos, I spoke a little bit about a great man that I was exposed to, Rav Michal Yehuda Lifkovich. His yahrzeit is today, actually. So I'll just relate a little anecdote from the Chazon Ish that very much personifies who he was. The Chazal say, "Mila b'sela shtika b'tre." Sometimes even a word that's worthwhile, it's worth a sela. Sela, let's call it a dollar for our purposes. Sometimes when a word is worth a dollar, often a word just gets you into deficit, right? It's not worth a dollar. It's not worth a penny. Sometimes it just gets you $10 minus, right? But let's say, because I'm making a point, sometimes when a word is worth a dollar, keeping quiet could be worth $2, right? That's a cloud they say. When a word is worth a dollar, keeping quiet is worth two. So somebody once asked the Chazon Ish, which is kind of a silly question, but the Chazon Ish's response is so profound. They said to the Chazon Ish, keeping quiet is worth $2, right? But we are granting that speaking is worth a dollar. So if I only have one word to say, and I won't say that word, it's a dollar. If I keep quiet, it's two. But if I say three words, it's worth $3, right? So you picked up on this. So the question is kind of silly, but nevertheless, listen to what the Chazon Ish answered. The Chazon Ish said, no, it doesn't necessarily mean that keeping quiet is better. What it means is, if you have a word that's worth a dollar, but it's preceded by silence, the silence before the word is worth two. Then when you say the word is worth three. That is so classic of the Chazon Ish way of thinking, so profound. Follow the Cheshbon? If you don't follow that, please speak up, because this is an important one. I'm gonna say it again. So it doesn't mean that you have a choice. Do I say the word or do I not? If I say the word, it's a dollar. If I don't say the word, it's two. He said, no. You have a word that's worthwhile to say, be quiet for a moment, give it thought. That silence before saying the word is worth $2. Then when you go and say the word, it's worth a dollar, you've got three. The word preceded by the silence, by the thought that went into it, is worth $3. And so classic of the Chazon Ish. So the truth is that I might say it's a certain common denominator in my experience of exposure to the Gedolim who were yet in yeshiva in Europe, right? The pre-war Gedolim. I had this course of being exposed to people with very different personalities. Rabbi Victor Miller and this Rabbi Michal Yehuda, the outside is today, very different personalities. Rabbi Victor Miller was intense. And kind of the way I put it yesterday was, you speak about the gaze of a great person. Rabbi Victor Miller's gaze was penetrating. It was intense. And Michal Yehuda's gaze was soft, and caressing. Wasn't anything intense about it. It was, but so Rabbi Yehuda was soft, soft-spoken, gentle. Rabbi Avigdor Miller was tough, demanding, and each inspired, each exposed you to different facets of greatness. The way I might put it is that Rabbi Yehuda, in Rabbi Avigdor Miller, you saw the majesty of Etzel HaMelikim. In Rabbi Yehuda, you saw the beauty of Etzel HaMelikim. It was like, whatever the case is, what am I getting at was that with all these people, a certain common denominator was that they spoke slowly and deliberately. People sometimes surprised to hear, but Avigdor Miller, with all his outspokenness and with all his sharpness and his shiurim, when he spoke to him privately, that's not what you saw. He spoke with a lot of reserve. When he said a shiur, he was obviously knew what he wanted to say. So he let it out, right? But when he was having a conversation, there wasn't anything impulsive. Words were measured. And with Rabbi Michal Yehuda also, it was like, he said a word, then he said another word. It wasn't a string of words. He said a word, then he said another word. There were pauses between the words. It was slow, deliberate, and your mamash felt how each word carried weight, right? It was mamash how the Chazon Ish said it. The silence before the word added that much more value to the word. Same thing also with Rabbi Shlomo Volba. So as a man who could, I mean, it took an interesting, a little bit of a different form. You could ask him a question and he wouldn't answer. Sometimes it was because he chose not to answer. But sometimes, 5 minutes later, 7 minutes later, he would suddenly answer. Was it something that you saw by him? It wasn't an answer, he was thinking, and he was thinking, and he was thinking. Question we might consider a simple question. That was a certain common denominator, was the deliberateness in speech. So I'm just drawing on this as an example when we talk about Chochmah v'Sichlus as a midah, not as a natural ability, right? IQ. But as putting thought in, investing thought into things we say, thinking before acting, etc. Versus not doing so. Hagvura v'amayrech, bravery versus fear. As we'll see later, each one has its place. There are places where you should not be afraid. You should be brave. And there are places where much better to be afraid. Hanedivus v'akilus, generosity versus stinginess. Hatzedek v'aresha, a sense of righteousness versus the opposite. Haboshes va'azus, being brazen versus being bashful. Hatikva va'ira, hope versus, I'll call it, okay, fear. Yeah. Ha'ava va'asina, love versus hate. Ha'ano va'atzar. This is also something interesting that deserves elaboration. But pleasure versus distress. Okay. Also, we're going to have to talk about how those can be midas versus you enjoy what you enjoy. Agaiva v'anova. Okay. We all know what that means, right? Arrogance versus humility. Hasorah v'ashiflus. This is not exactly the same as gaiva. Sorah means acting when a person implements his prestige. Right? That isn't always necessarily gaiva. When you have, let's say, a person who has to assert himself as a leader, that often will be very correct. Vashiflus versus acting lowly, each one has its place. Whatever it is, maybe other such examples that operate inside you. These are many of the mediums that are the causes behind, they're activating the good things we do or the not such good things that we do. Okay, now let's take a step back for a minute and really get back to what you raised before. The Chavos of Avos is telling us that we're basically guided by two guides, right? And we have all these different forces in us, right? That whole list that we just described of natural feelings are all going to be guided by these two guides. And what are the two guides? The two guides are the intellect versus the natural urges, the natural impulses. So let's discuss this a little bit to understand how this works. I want to draw on a few examples in order to get straight to the finer elements. But we all understand, for example, that when we're talking mamish just about physical impulses, we all understand that they have to be guided by seichel. We talk about eating. Eating has to be guided by seichel. If eating is not guided by seichel, we understand that it gets a person not to a good place. Just talking physically, right? It has to be guided by seichel. That's simple and straightforward enough. And many other things, if a person's going to follow his natural impulses, right? If a person would love to build a big business or develop a successful career, right? But his natural urges he prefers horizontal position rather than a vertical position, right? So it's not going to work. That's his natural instinct. That's his natural instinct. You have to be guided by the seichel. So Chaim Salamis is telling us these are two guides, advisors, advising you in different directions.
I've heard, especially the Ram also talking, there's like two souls there that war with each other, the Nefesh Bahama, right, and the Nefesh Elohim. Are these similar to that?
That's right. You're raising a good point. These will have various parallels in terms of the way it's expressed. You might have it expressed as the Nefesh Bahamis versus the Nefesh Elikis. You might have it expressed as the Nefesh versus the Neshama, as the Guf versus the Neshama, et cetera, et cetera. That's right.
Intellect doesn't capture Neshama in mind. Like, intellect is just your brain, the things. It doesn't have a soul. So the word intellect doesn't.
Oh, so that's right. The Chaim Salvavis is usage, the Chaim Salvavis is phraseology, is more philosophical than spiritual, if we put it that way. He'll use more the term seichel than neshama. But just to draw, for example, on the Sfarno, who says that this seichel is the most physical expression of the neshama. Right? So, yeah, we are talking about that. Now, it's true. If we're just going to limit it to intellect without understanding that the Chaim Salvavis is really referring to something deeper, you have to realize that the intellect can also be easily harnessed into the service of the natural impulses, right? Intellect can turn into a slave of my desire to eat. That's right. So yes, you're definitely right that really the Chaim Salvavis is alluding at something deeper. And the simplest way to put it would be the Yetzer Tov versus the Yetzer Hara. So yeah, what we're talking about is the part of us that is pulling us toward connecting with Hashem, the part of us that's pushing us toward higher goals, and the part of us that's just working with the here and now, instant gratification, etc. That's right. And as we saw earlier, the Chaim Salvavis has already alluded to this earlier in this shiur, and he said that when we're talking about that struggle, the natural impulses have the home team advantage. We're talking about a tug of war between the neshama and the guf. Right? How often does it happen that, you know, I feel like I want to eat something, I know I really should, but I just succumb to the force of the neshama and I just neglect to do it, right? But in the opposite direction, that often will be the case, right? That could happen. So here's how we need to frame it. The natural impulses, for example, the desire to eat, very physical desire. So he's framing that right now as the Yetzer Hara, but we all understand that if you will decide that this is a Yetzer Hara that I will never listen to, 3 days and then, right? So obviously what we're talking about here is allowing the seichel, or the neshama, as expressed by the seichel, to control it all in a broad way. And I think this is also going to answer the question you raised earlier. We're talking about giving the seichel, letting the seichel lay down the goals, letting the seichel provide the guidelines, and then to let your impulses become something kadosh, to let all of your midas become something kadosh by operating according to the broad dictates of the seichel. But certainly they're given their expression. The Taivas Achila is there to remind you that you still are in a goof, right? And Hashem wants you to stay there for a while. Hashem doesn't want you to leave so quickly. So the goof sends a humble reminder up to the neshama. The neshama might say, wait a little bit, you haven't finished learning yet. Half hour goes by, and the goof sends still a humble, but a little bit more of a you know, urgent. And then the seichel says, okay, the time has come. And the guf is given its, that's already a different story, right? So we're talking about, yes, the natural impulses being brought under the control of the seichel, being guided by the seichel, then being allowed to operate, So we all understand this when it comes to mamish, our physical urges. That we all understand. But I want to take it a little further. I want to show some more subtle examples of this, but something that's important. Let's say, for example, I'll give one example, and I hope that this will provide a lot of insight to various scenarios. Another kid who's never careful at the table, right? Never careful at the table, and you told him a million times. And when he pours things, he has to do it carefully, etc. And you're Baruch Hashem, your persistence is holding up. You've never tired of repeating the same thing, and he just doesn't seem to get it. And then, by Yi Ayoyim, and once again, as he's pouring the milk, knocks over the cup of milk. Well, you know what he says? Oh, and he quickly grabs the pitcher of milk and, you know, picks it back up before the whole thing manages to spill and starts wiping up the spill. So here, you might feel a natural, but again, you picked it up exactly the way I told you so many times not to pick it up. I told you to use two hands, etc. And then, what will the chinuch people tell you? They'll say, kol hakavod, you caught it like that. And I like the fact, kol hakavod, that you took those napkins right away and started wiping it up. This is one example, right? This is relevant to kids, relevant to spouses, relevant to all of the kids. But sometimes there'll be a certain question of, I'm going to say kol hakavod, that's not really what I'm feeling. Am I supposed to not be real? See, I had the way Rabbi Victor Miller expressed it. He spoke straight, posh, and blunt. Be an actor. Yes, it's important to be an actor. No, don't be real. You want to be overly real, you'll find yourself getting into trouble all over life. And it's more important to have positive, healthy relationships than to be real. That was his way of putting it. But I want to actually say it along these lines. This is the way I heard it expressed by my other Rebbe, Michiel Jakobson. He spoke about this in a Chinuch concept, but also expanding it to general Avodas Hashem, to understand that natural is not always real. For example, let's take this example that we just spoke about. Your instinctive reaction is the frustration over the fact that you told the kid 50 million times, exactly, even though before it was a million, but it can quickly get to 50 million, right? And why couldn't he, what is the big deal about using the other hand every time with one hand, right? What is the big deal about just take that other hand and put it on the bottle too, right? And that's what I feel right now. Are you telling me no? Deep breath and say, no, you picked up the shmat. It's not what I'm feeling right now. But you say, but 1 minute. What do you really want to be conveying to the kid? Take a step back for a minute. Let's say I ask you about this later at night when the kid's fast asleep. In those cases where the kid does do that, do you want to be encouraging him to take responsibility for things that he did? Or do you always want to be just getting home that point? You didn't use your second hand. You still aren't picking up the milk bottle like a mensch. Or do you want to encourage? He took responsibility here. Do I want to be able to further that? What's more important to you? When it's not at the time, right? And when the kid's fast asleep, if you didn't think of it more than that, when you're standing over his bed looking at him when he's asleep, right? What do you want to be doing? 23 hours and 58 minutes of the day, you would want to be doing the latter reaction. When do you want to do the former reaction? When the milk spills. Because then you're frustrated. When I'm not frustrated, I'll tell you that what I want to be doing is the other reaction, right? So which is real? Natural and real aren't necessarily synonymous. Being unnatural often means going a little deeper to what I really am and want, right? So this is a very chashev, a finer aspect of what the Chazal is talking about here, about being guided by the seichel versus by the natural instincts. But Rabbi Avigdor Miller said, yes, be an actor. If we're going to put it into those these terms, what we need to say is, remember what you really want to be expressing. Remember the feelings that you really want to be conveying, right? And this is what we're talking about. Allowing this seichel to dictate the seichel is what's working in an objective way that we're not actually put to the test. What do I really want to be doing? Where do I really want to be going? And then say to yourself, on the contrary, it's not natural versus fake. It's natural versus real. So, no, don't just follow the natural impulse and say, well, I'm an honest type. Go real. Say, wait for a minute. Back up for a minute. What do I really want to be expressing here? After I let it out, 5 minutes later, what will I be feeling? Right? Then you'll be back to the real feelings. You'll feel lousy about yourself. Right? And say, I didn't want him to spill the milk again, but I also didn't want to explode like that again. Right? So when we're talking about allowing the seichel to guide things, what that means is, yes, let's get our natural responses under the broad guidance of the seichel. When it is, yes, then certainly there's room for natural impulses to have their expression, as we talked about. The simplest physical urges, eating, sleeping, etc., right? And also these other things, the emotions. The emotions are a very, very powerful part of our avodas Hashem, but even then we want them to be in line. We want the seichel to be setting the goals. We want the seichel to be telling me, I want to be defining who do I really want to be based on the seichel, and then harnessing the emotions into that building. A person who will raise children only based on seichel, a child will be lacking a lot, right? You want the child to be getting the intensity of your love, the intensity of your excitement, right, about different things going on. But on the other hand, you also don't want it to just be led by the emotions, which often will conceal what you really want. So we want the seichel to be setting the tone. We want to have an idea of what we want, what are our goals, what is the bigger picture of what we want for our families, for ourselves, etc. And then to let our emotions work under that. I'll approach this from another angle. The Kuzari is a very classic Kuzari. When he's asked to describe, but you know how Kuzari is structured. It's a dialogue between a non-Jewish king and a Jewish chacham. The Jewish chacham, the Jewish sage, is presenting at length everything about Yiddishkeit. People think, I just want to dispel a certain misconception. People think Kuzari is a sefer about proving the truths of our moon. It's like one of these sparring that, you know, it's only, you hear, you know, it's only for those who really need it, this, that. That's not what Kuzari is. Kuzari is an unbelievable study of the full breadth and depth of Yiddishkeit. And the way I kind of think of it is, the relationship between Kuzari and Kodesh Avav is, forget that. It's a very, very profound, enriching sefer that just puts you into a whole different world as far as Yiddishkeit goes. One of the problems that the Kuzari king has with Yiddishkeit is that he says, I see more piety by other religions. I see more piety by other religions. In other religions you have, it's the word ascetics, is that how you say it? The people who are out there living in the mountains, was it monks, right? Living, wearing skins, eating only what they find, you know, the leaves or whatever it is, really living lives of purity and piety, etc. In Judaism, I just don't see those people. Everybody's part of the social circle. Everybody's married. Everybody's doing business. Everybody, where's the piety in Yiddishkeit? So the Kuzari says, it's true, we have a very different concept of piety. It's a long discussion, but when the Kuzari king asks him, can you define for me the chassid, the pious person, in Jewish terms? So he says, the pious person is the person who rules his kingdom properly. He makes sure that all of his citizens are given their needs, but at the same time, he keeps them under control, has a firm hand on the affairs of his state, and He doesn't allow, he doesn't stand for lack of discipline. People have to be following his orders, etc. All description of a very, very balanced ruler, fair ruler. So the king says to him, "Wait a minute, I asked you to describe the pious person. You're talking about a ruler. I can hear that this is a very high quality ruler. But I'm asking you about the ordinary person. Ordinary person wants to be pious." He says, "No, I'm talking about the ordinary person. I'm talking about the ordinary person. Each of us has a whole system of forces operating inside us. If we'll take the mashal of, let's say, an army. Okay? So let's say you have an army where there's a very, very high quality navy, a very high quality air force, very high quality infantry, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, the head of the navy knows that the way to go is through sea battles. And whenever there's some sort of threat to the country, he goes out there with his boats, and he's ready to take up the battle. You know, the head of the Air Force knows that the way to go about it is with the planes. And he's out there bombing, right? And there's no coordination between the two. And the planes are busy bombing their own boats, right? So you can have very, very powerful arms of the army. They're not coordinated. They're not operating under one central command. And they're busy fighting each other and making messes, and just nothing is working. That's why you need the commander-in-chief who says, no, this is where the Navy operates. This is where the Air Force operates. Here we're going to use this. We can't just have all the different units of the army deciding, hey, it needs to be an operation there. We're all just going to charge forward. No, this is only going to be, wait a minute, you're not going to use my planes? How can you not use my planes? The country's in danger. That's right, because this is something I want to assign to the Navy, right? He says, we have all these different forces operating in us, all these different koiches. And like you said before, these are important needs, but we can't allow them to decide, each one to decide, each urge on its own to decide, each impulse, each character trait to decide on its own to operate. No, there has to be a commander that has a plan, and that game plan is what the Torah expects. And therefore, sometimes even needs like generosity will be told, I'm sorry, you don't have a free hand. You don't have a free hand. Midas like Rachmanis. Sometimes the commander will have to put even the Midas of Rachmanis in place. In general, the commander tells the Midas of Rachmanis, pretty much have a free reign. You pretty much have a free reign. Do what you need to do. While the Midas of Achzarius is kept on the army base, right, under closed quarters, and, you know, just stay here, right? But every so often, the Midas of Rachmanis wants to run a little too far up. No, you can't go further than this. Or sometimes you can say, now we have to put you away and unleash the Midah of Achzarius. Even the Midas Kedoshis have to be under the control of the one who's controlling the broad game plan. And who's that? That's you, guided by the Seichel / the Neshama. Then all of your different Midas and even all of your different physical urges will all be powerfully carrying you toward that goal of Bezos Hashem. Okay, we'll give a moment for any questions. And as we reiterate, if there are no questions, don't feel awkward. A moment of just keeping quiet is a better.
$2.
That's right.
That's because it's very clear. Very clear. Thank you.
Yashar koach. Yashar koach. Okay. A good avach raboisai. There's a question here. If tikva is hope, how does that correspond to yira, which is awe? Good question. How does tikva, in the Buddhists that were mentioned, we mentioned tikva versus yira. Hope versus awe. So the truth is that here we probably have to assume